morning, and welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're going to turn back to the second statement that Yahweh etched in stone. We have Larry still with us. Frank has called in from Washington. Frank is really an expert on the discussion we had yesterday on marriage, divorce, and family matters, both initially from the Christian perspective and now from Yah's. But let me at least reground us in the statement that Yahweh made. Second of the three statements, that he etched us, that he etched in stone on our behalf, after he told us that he was Yahweh, that that was his one and only name, that he himself had engaged as our Savior, that that was his role, not someone else's role, and that we would not exist if we chose to show homage to other gods. He then tells us we ought not be religious, and instead of being religious, he says that we should observe the terms and conditions of his covenant, and that that is the means, in addition to walking to him so that we come to love him, approaching him so that we can come to love him, that his mercy is delivered. Let's go through this, and then we'll turn back to both Frank and to Larry. You should never, ever do anything which associates yourself with a carved image or idol or any object of worship or patronage. For any visual representation of something which is in the heavens above, or which is on the earth below, or which is in the waters beneath the land. In other words, the Pope hat, that, in fact, the Pope is now carrying a cross that has fish on both sides of the cross. The Dagon hat that he wears is a fish hat. You ought not do that. You ought not have, you ought not even carry crosses around. That would be a graven image. The U.S. Currency is filled with graven images. Almost all political symbols in the United States and for other countries are images of these very things. You should never bow down or acquiesce to them, never worship them or speak to them or for them, and you should never serve them. That would eliminate government service, military service, and any form of religious service in terms of if you want to pay attention to what God has said here. You cannot go into, under this basis, a religious building. You can't be religious. You can't be patriotic in terms of serving your government. You should never bow down and worship them, speak for them, or speak to them, and you should never serve them. For indeed, I, Yahweh, your God, am a zealous and jealous God. Now, so this God being jealous is being set into the context of him advising us that we ought not be engaged politically or religiously. That is the context which it is set. So if you were to take, I am a jealous God, I, Yahweh, am a jealous God, and you were to take that out of context, you could probably misconstrue it. This is the context it is presented in. He is intolerant of us and unwilling to share us with religious institutions, with political institutions, with us serving and speaking on behalf of and bowing down and worshiping and, you know, taking our hats off our heads and putting our hands on our heart as we speak on behalf of or make a testament on behalf of a political or religious institution. For indeed, I, Yahweh, your God, am a zealous and jealous God, counting and reckoning the perversity of sin, of twisting and distorting of the fathers upon the children concerning the third and fourth generations of those who are genuinely hostile to me. Again, this is all one sentence, and it flows from for indeed. He's saying because of the religious malfeasance, the religious and political adherence of most people, their willingness to acquiesce and to be subservient to political and religious institutions, God is saying that is the sin of corruption, that is the sin of distorting that goes from father to son for generations. There's a picture on one of the Reuters news feeds that I was looking at this morning during a commercial break, and it shows a mosque with a bunch of Muslims mooning God while bowing down before Satan, and there's a little child about 1.5 years old that is trying to emulate them. That is the consequence of religion. And then God says, but I, Yahweh, will genuinely act and actually engage to literally prepare, perform, and produce unmerited and unfailing mercy, unearned favor, and undeserved kindness, chesed, on behalf of thousands who move toward me and come to love me, who approach me by closely observing and carefully considering my terms, the terms and conditions of my covenant. My friend Frank, it's good to have you as part of the program. You spent much of your time as a marriage and family counselor on behalf of Christianity, and were in as deeply into Christianity as I was, maybe even more deeply, and have come to know that Christianity is false. And now do the same kind of counseling, but on behalf of the covenant. And I think what you've learned is that the covenant really is God's view of family and marriage and how we are to live with one another, in addition to how we live with him.
Correct. Good morning, Yada. And you are right. The biggest thing that I think that we really have to understand is exactly what you were saying, that the covenant, Yah's covenant, is representation of the marriage covenant, or is a marriage covenant.
Mm-hmm.
Just as in his name, we would see the two upright beings as being Abraham and Sarah.
Yeah.
We too see this as husband and wife. And
yeah.
We need to look at the marriage covenant as the covenant that, or in resemblance to, if you will, as the covenant that Yah has with us. And
yeah, in fact, let me interrupt there 1 second. The two people you're talking, the two beings that you mentioned that are standing upright are the husband and wife, the man and the woman, the mother and father. Those two individuals that are standing upright aren't standing upright just any old where. They actually form the basis of Yahweh's name.
That's right.
So in addition to those two individuals, there's only two other letters in Yahweh's name. One is his hand reaching down and out to us, and the tent peg, which is symbolic of enlarging and securing a home.
Right.
And so the two individuals you're talking about, they literally form the basis of Yahweh's name, which tells us that his covenant is the reason that all of this exists.
Exactly. And the tent peg in the middle between the two upright beings, the husband and the wife,
mm-hmm.
is all about expanding the family, not only the individual family that would be the children, but the family of God.
Right.
And this is about covenant. It's
yeah.
very evident in Jeremiah that he's telling us that his people, especially if we go from Jeremiah 3 to Jeremiah 7, that his people, Israel,
mm-hmm.
which we would literally look at in that text is talking about Israel and Judah, but literally mm-hmm. Israel, that they do not know or understand his covenant. And when we go further down in Jeremiah 7, basically 21 to about 28, we actually see, like in 23, that he tells them about that he gave certain commands, and then, of course, in all of the English, it says that obey me.
And actually, he didn't give any commands, and he doesn't have a word for obey, does
right.
he?
So when we get into English, obviously, it can get us in trouble there. But
right.
Because
what does he actually see? You know what the actual Hebrew word is under where it has been changed to obey?
Right. It's Shema.
It says, yes, yeah, and Shema means listen to me.
That's right.
Yeah, and the word for command was actually the word, Hebrew word for instruction. I'm providing instructions, and I'm encouraging you to listen to me.
That's right. And basically, when we take a look and really understand what he was really saying, it's
mm-hmm.
about hearing and perceiving. It's about having a concern for what was being said.
Right.
It's even having the ability and the power to hear and to have your interest about what is being said, to get, come on, pay attention to me. This is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And it's something about giving your consent and agreeing. So when we enter into a marriage covenant between husband and wife, we are coming into agreement and consent with the covenant of Yah. Now, obviously, when we all came through the Jesus door, whatever door we happened to come through, and we entered into marriage, some of those things we may have understood, but basically very few people even today starting to understand covenant, understand what we were entering into when we entered into the covenant agreement of marriage. And our pattern is His very covenant, His very name, explaining the essence of how He's reaching down to us, how we are reaching up to Him, expanding the family, the mother and father, expanding His covenant even, or we're not expanding His covenant, but sharing His covenant. And that the ultimate thing that we have to understand in marriage is that we did enter into this, literally maybe not understanding what we were doing, but today we need to start shaking ourselves in marriage and start to understand the covenant relationship, the terms and agreements that He has, because they are the same terms and agreements that we face in marriage. It's the exact same things that we have to deal with. And yesterday after our conversation, I've been thinking and looking and reading, and this is a very big subject. It's not, it's just not something that we can put a little quick Band-Aid on. But the essence comes down to that we have to, in marriage, know that this is a very honorable institute, if you will, just as His covenant is, and that we are to honor that. Just as He looks at all of the all of the words that He's using about how Israel is unfaithful and committing adultery and on and on and on.
Yeah, and when He's talking about Israel committing adultery, and most of His conversation about adultery has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with marital infidelity in the sense of a sexual act. It is all it's all about a engaging in the very thing that the second instruction was talking about. It's corrupted and twisted and perverted Yah's testimony so that they became religious, and their adultery was the fact that they became religious, they became political, they chose to have false gods and false objects of worship in their lives, and they left Yahweh. That was their crime of adultery, and that's the crime of adultery we ought to keep in mind when God speaks of it. We'll be back with Shattering Myths in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We have both Larry and Frank on the line. We're talking about the covenant, talking about marriage and divorce and these sorts of things from a follow-up conversation that we had yesterday. For the most part, when Yahweh speaks of infidelity, even adultery in marriage, when He divorced the children of Israel in Hosea, He was specifically talking about the very thing that He outlined that He was opposed to, the reason He's jealous, the thing that He called corrupting and opposed to Him in the second of the three statutes that he instructions, overall statements that He etched in stone, and said explicitly, you know, if you're going to be religious. Now, this follows, by the way, a statement which says, I'm your Savior. My name is Yahweh. You will not exist with any other gods in my presence. And it follows where He talks about man's propensity to make religious and political objects of worship. And He says, that's a distortion, that's a corruption. I'm not going to tolerate that. I am jealous of my and zealous of my family, so I'm not going to tolerate that. If you want to be with me, you will not engage in those things, and instead you'll walk to me, approach me by coming to love me, by observing my terms and conditions of my covenant.
And so, you know, he also he also uses the term, you know, prostitutes and loathes prostitutes, whores.
Yes,
and
but,
you know, I mean,
but even
in the religious aspects of
correct. Yeah, the prostitutes that he's talking about, he's not talking about men engaging in sex by buying sex from prostitutes. No, even the prostitutes that he speaks of are temple prostitutes. and by extrapolation, men who prostitute themselves by pretending to serve others in the name of God. He's talking about popes and priests and rabbis, all of whom who act as prostitutes,
right,
soliciting people's money. Yeah.
Yep.
You know, I was looking at just a moment ago at Bereth, the Hebrew word for covenant relationship, which Larry correctly stated is also a marriage vow. So let's look how it was actually conveyed to us, because as Larry has said, and Frank, you've said in a number of times, that even if you are illiterate, you don't know Hebrew at all, by looking at the graphic symbols that were used to convey these words that Yahweh has revealed to us, you can figure them out. So let me share the components that make up this covenant, this family, of which God is mostly concerned that we don't approach his family by dragging religious and political muck with us, that we will be excluded, that his family is inclusive only of those things that are true. He begins it with the Hebrew letter Beath. The Hebrew letter Beath actually means family. Beath is the Hebrew word for home. It was drawn as the floor plan of a home with one way in. Now, you can look at the floor plan of this home, which has one way in, as like a blueprint, and you can see, all right, there's the entrance to the home, or you can look at it because it's drawn with the entrance up. You can say, well, the only way into this home is God's entrance, the upper entrance. And if it's a floor plan like that, you can also see that it's protected with a roof. But family and home and a floor plan for a home with one way in is the first letter of Bereth, the Hebrew word for family covenant relationship. The second the Hebrew word letter Rosh. Rosh is we used to be Resh. It means in Hebrew still to this moment top, first, beginning, best. This is not just the first family. It's not just the best family. It's not just the highest ranking family because it's God's family. But the letter Rosh was conveyed by drawing a picture of a human head. And what is there on the head that might help you get inside of this home? Well, you've got eyes that you can use to read, right?
That's right.
Frank a moment ago talked about obey in your English Bible, which doesn't say that at all. It says, listen, you've got ears which can listen to the word of God if you recite it, right?
Correct.
So you've got a couple of input devices, and then you've got a means to respond with your mouth, but not before the input into your ears and into your eyes passes through your brain where you can come to understand what you have learned. You come to know through observation, through processing through your brain, you come to understand, and then you're in a position to respond. That's why the head is shown there. We'll get back to the visual representation of the family relationship with Yahweh after the commercial break. Now, welcome back to Shattering Mist. I'm your host, Yada. We're considering the pictorial representation of Bereth, the single most important word in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. It's a word that's actually reflected in Yahweh's name. But the first letter is the Hebrew word for family, Beath. It is drawn depicting a home with a single way in. The second letter is Rosh, which speaks of that family being the first, the best, the top, and also it speaks of beginnings, which is the entire reason the universe was created, was for this covenant relationship. But it was drawn with showing a person's head from a profile point of view, emphasizing that we have eyes and ears to read, to listen, a brain to process information, and then a mouth to respond once we understand. The third letter in Bereth is a yod, which was originally called a yad, which is the Hebrew word for hand. It's drawn with the upper arm reaching down, the forearm reaching out, and an open hand at the end. It's unmistakable. It's the first letter in Yahweh's name. It says that those of us who want to be part of God's home, his family, Beth, who use our eyes and ears to observe what God has said and listen to what he has said and process what he has said and respond to him, are in a position where we can grasp hold of his hand, which is being offered to us with an open hand to lift us up. The final letter is a teth. In Hebrew, was drawn initially as a circle with an X in the middle of it. It symbolized being surrounded, being protected, being enclosed, and having one's mark or signature on that enclosure. That's what it conveys. It also shows the sign of a doorway and the upright support beams for a home. So we have God's signature, his mark on his protective enclosure, his promise to protect us in his home for those of us who listen to him, who observe what he has to say, who respond to him, and who reach up and grasp his hand.
Okay, so this is part of what I try to emphasize to everybody in understanding marriage is that they have to understand covenant in order to be able to actually understand what they have entered into in a marriage covenant. And also, as we understand covenant, that there literally are terms and conditions for the covenant, as there are terms and conditions for our marriage covenant, is that there are consequences that happen. Just as the word tells what happened to Israel, mm-hmm. what the defilement of the land was, the holding back of the rain, the crops weren't producing, all kinds of things were going bad. They basically were Torahlessness, or there was Torahlessness there. They were without Torah. They were without covenant. And everything around them was going to hell in a handbasket.
That was a tangible representation of what God was offering spiritually as it relates to his family, was it not? I mean, you talk about terms and conditions. Well, there are terms and conditions that are determined whether or not we participate. Our response to five terms and conditions determine whether we participate. But God, on the other side, is bound to the five promises. So he has terms and conditions that he is bound to uphold. He cannot, under any circumstances, withhold the benefits of the covenant should we accept the conditions of the covenant. And so what he was showing through Yisrael, through their violation of this marriage and this covenant, was that there are consequences, trying to tangibly communicate the consequences of rejecting, dishonoring, breaking, disavowing the agreement. Just as if you and I form a business agreement with someone and we renege on the terms, there's consequences of that.
That's correct. Well, and we have to see that there are consequences in our marriage. And I still, as my understanding of Yah and how he looks at things, which is totally different than how I once looked at things from a Christian standpoint, because obviously I was so deeply steeped in the Pauline doctrine that it was lording over and mastering and everything.
Yeah, women being subject to men and us being lorded over even by God.
That's right. But you know, now that we've thrown that out, we're getting rid of the colored glasses that we look through. Colored glasses of the world, colored glasses of Pauline doctrine, colored glasses of Judaism, colored glasses of every religion and every teaching that comes down, and whoever writes a book, and I mean, it gets on and on and on. Everybody has to take off the colored glasses when they're coming back, and I believe this in a marriage relationship as well as looking at the covenant of Yah, that they have to come back to a point, start taking off the glasses, start looking at what the terms and conditions are of the covenant agreement that they have entered into. My understanding of Yah really is that he hates divorce. Yes, he does allow it. Yes, he did divorce Israel and Judah. Yes, all that. But he still hates it because it destroys the family unit with which he created the covenant
right.
and the marriage covenant.
But it is a consequence. If you know, there is Yahweh put himself in a position where he could to do nothing other than divorce himself of Yisrael and Yehudim, as well as most of humanity, because we have either ignored or violated the terms and conditions of the covenant.
Right,
and
by his fault.
His response is dictated upon him. He has absolutely no choice in the matter. You know, God had a choice. He could create the covenant any way he wanted to. I mean, he could create the universe any way he wanted to. He had his expression of free will. But within his expression of free will, he has made certain statements. And the statements that he have made relative to the covenant, which is, if you embrace these five things, if you accept these five things, come to know what they are, understand them, and respond to them, then these are the five things I'm going to do for you.
That's right.
He has eliminated his ability to choose otherwise.
Right. Well, in the marriage, in the marriage vow or marriage covenant, we're
right.
facing the same thing.
That's exactly right.
We don't like using the words of blessing and curses, but
right.
basically there are benefits and there are consequences.
Correct.
And families who are facing the consequences is because of their disobedience to the covenant, not only to the marriage covenant, but to...
Yeah, I wouldn't use disobedience, but I would say they're either ignorance of it
yes.
or their rejection of it.
Yeah, their rejection of it. Well, it's ignorance. It's not disobedience in the sense of we would use... That's, okay, I got a little Pauline glasses on.
Yeah. Paul likes the word obedience. He uses it all the time. You know, you either it's funny. He claims that the Torah is this the law that you have to obey, and how that's bad when the Torah isn't law; it's teaching, and there is no Hebrew word for obey. It's an instruction just to listen to and then respond to it however you choose. Of which there's benefits and consequences depending on how you respond.
Right.
Paul uses obedience all over the place. In Pauline doctrine, you have to obey what Paul is dishing out, or you're condemned.
And I thought that I had taken the glasses off completely. I'm still using
my friend, as you and I have talked often, we were so immersed in Christianity that it is really tough to shed all of its legacy. We can understand, but we'll still, and I do it all the time, fall back into the Pauline kind of nomenclature, if you will. Wordology, and it's very difficult to do, but particularly here I clearly understood what you were saying. We're trying to be as precise as we can be in terms
right.
of Yahweh's testimony. So we are going to challenge any bit of that wordology that comes from our path. In a marriage, by the way, there is no obedience. Yeah, go ahead.
Yesterday, I did a five-hour running battle with some 20-odd Christians on FB, several different posts. And, I literally got to the point, Jossie brought this up, she read the thread, that if these people have met Yahweh, they would actually
hate him.
argue with him.
Yeah, they would dislike him.
With him.
Yeah.
It sounds like what we used to do.
Yeah. In fact, I was talking with Frank yesterday, Larry, about this very thing, that Christians will first claim that you and I have misinterpreted God's testimony to come to these conclusions. And so my response to them is always, so you're telling me that the God who created the universe through words, the God who conceived the language of life called DNA, the author of the Torah is such a poor communicator that it is impossible for us to actually understand what he said. Is that the argument that you're going to use to refute what God said? And if that's a pretty demeaning view of God, isn't it?
They quoted Galatians and Romans.
Of course, Romans. Right.
And I laid down Yahusha.
Right.
That you people that are Torahless, I don't know you from my
right.
I laid down any anyone who disregards the Torah, even their prayers are an abomination from the Psalm.
Yes.
I laid down the Mizmor, or Psalm, that the Torah is complete for redeeming soul, and the guy says,
right.
The Torah is dead.
Yeah.
Are you saved?
Yeah.
Mean, these people were like wind-up souls,
and
their God was Paul.
So, yeah, so what they're saying is that Yahweh's testimony, when he said that his Torah is complete, and that it is fully capable of restoring the soul, and that the Torah is easy to understand so long as you are open-minded.
Yeah, that you understand God's, the seven Moed, big red,
that, right,
walks
right,
through it.
Right, that he speaks so glowingly of the Torah. He says that the glory is forever, and that the Torah is his means to save us. That when God said those things, that what they're saying is because Paul contradicted that, that in the argument between Yahweh says one thing, Paul says the opposite, that Paul is right, and that they still think they have a relationship with God, that you can be saved by a God whom Paul said is untrustworthy and wrong. I mean,
well,
think about the stupidity of that. You can be saved by a God that Paul says lied to you, is untrustworthy, and is wrong. And Romans 7, by the way, says that the Torah is dead. That's Paul's claim.
These people actually believe that the Torah is a list of 681 laws.
I think it's 613, and that's supposed to be the number of seeds in a pomegranate and the number of bones in the human body, neither of which is correct. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment, because there's lots of them. Well, welcome back to the final segment of Shattering Myths. Larry, what you were saying resonates with me because of what Yahweh just said in this second of three statements on the first of those two tablets. What you concluded was that when you confront a Christian, a Pauline advocate, with Yahweh's own statements relative to the role his Torah plays in our lives, that their response is to quote Paul, and they reject what Yahweh said. Now, that says two things. It's unmistakable that it says two things, if you're rational. One is that you don't like God very much. And that's what God is saying here in this particular statement, in the second statement, that those who twist and convolute the things of God to be religious instead actually despise God. They hate him. So it's not that they wouldn't recognize God if he were to approach them. They would hate him. And the second thing is that because they cite as scripture, the only thing that they think is valuable isn't the Torah, prophets, and Psalms from Yahweh. And they won't even acknowledge what Yahusha said in the Sermon on the Mount, which is what you quoted in Matanyah 7. But they quote Paul as the source of divine revelation, which means that Paul has become their God.
Yes, it does. And it's not only that. We have parchment 72 of Peter, Peter starts out saying, first of all, Paul says he speaks with the authority of the Ruach, and he's beyond lying, and he can never tell a lie, and he says he speaks with human understanding. But
right.
If you go through that, what does Shimon actually say? He says at the end of that not to read Paul's letters. For what reason? Because it will lead to what? Torahlessness.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Right there. If Peter said,
let me take you back here. Come on, let's go back here. I want to take you guys back just a minute.
Yes.
I want to make sure that I don't miss this little piece here. Yes, you're right.
Yes.
But I want to talk to Carol and Kimberly because they called in yesterday and they had these issues that they're dealing with. You know what? They are in the most powerful position that any spouse is in because they are in a covenant relationship with someone. And it's not like Larry trying to talk to somebody who has no relationship with him and doesn't want to listen. In the relationship, the covenant relationship that they have with their husbands, regardless of what the problems are and what's going on, if they are in a position to be able to help talk and bring understanding, does it mean that the husband or wife in any situation will listen? And
probably not.
You know, it's a possibility not. But they are in a more powerful position than any of us are trying to share with somebody about Torah,
right.
About
because they have nothing. They have nothing material to lose.
Right.
So, nothing materially negative can happen to them. Nothing from a long-term or eternal perspective bad can happen to them. They're in the strongest possible position in the world because Yahweh's five promises relative to them are totally and completely dependable.
Right. And Yah is in agreement with them trying to get their marriage to come
right.
into a place of agreement with the covenant.
Yes.
And so there it's a very strong and powerful place to be.
But
now, it doesn't mean that the divorce won't happen.
Frank, because of the fact that Larry is correct, that the problem that these women are both having is husbands that have taken Paul to be God. And
right.
because they are so swallowed up in the lies of Paul, whom Shibon specifically said was a deceiver, that he not only misled, but that his testimony made comprehension difficult, that because of the poison of Paul's pen, their husbands are in an adulterous relationship with God, and it will be very difficult for them to, either of them, to resolve that problem. And
right.
so that's the reason why Yahusha made it quite clear that to participate in the covenant, we not only have to walk away from religion and politics, from Babel, from corruption, but what was the second thing on that list which he said that you need to be prepared to walk away from?
Family.
Right.
Right.
So what they're experiencing is the natural consequence of what it means to choose Yahweh.
That's right. But Yahweh tells us, and I've got a butt in here, tells us that if we will return to him, if we will walk away from all of those things,
right.
and there is that possibility with them being in a covenant relationship that the spouse may. And this
may.
Doesn't just happen to men, or this is both sides.
Right.
But
may. There is that hope. So long as what is Yahweh said as it relates to his Torah, it's easy to understand if you're open-minded.
Right.
If their husbands choose to be receptive and open-minded, yes, there is hope for them.
Right.
Should
and
they choose Paul and they're going to lock on to Paul and hold on to Paul, then there is no hope.